Okay, any questions about the material that we covered last hour?
This is a real general question. Could it be such a thing as a set of maxims that will allow you to, and help you make descriptions from a different perspective of intellectual aspect?
What other perspective?
Say from an artistic aesthetic perspective.
Well, you might say it is that, because with the maxims, we're worrying about the correctness or truth of the description, and it is an aesthetic concern. Certainly isn't a hedonic one.
Well, not so much description, but like saying what would be principles for saying what would be actually aesthetic.
You wouldn't have maxims. Let me see if I can give you a comparable situation. Suppose that I wanted to write something down that would help you appreciate the game of bridge, and that it would also tell you how you play bridge. It's something to make a bridge player out of. What you would need is a more complex description of the game itself, at least some indications of the various possibilities, some other language that would identify major kinds of goals and different ways of doing it, some evaluation of kinds of strategies of how to do it, and maybe some examples of actual bridge games of which you could say this was well played and this one over here was poorly played and here's why. It seems to me it would take a package like that to get into the right ballpark with that problem. Now, if you think of games as a paradigm of almost any kind of human behavior, then how to make you a good artist would involve pretty much the same thing. It would be the same kind of package. It would be that complex. So a set of maxims wouldn't do it. Well, from time to time, I may ask you to take a sheet of paper out and write something down. And these will be exercises, the value of which consists of doing them. So right now, as an exercise, take a sheet of paper out and explain the notion of the role of the critic. Figure you've got somewhere between 5 and 10 minutes to do this. Finish the sentence you're writing and then stop. Okay, the purpose of an exercise like this is to enable you to review and recapitulate what you already know, and in so doing, possibly clarify questions that you might have and therefore be able to ask. So at this point, let me ask again, are there any questions about the notion of the role of the critic?
Different perspectives to the ethical, intellectual.
Ethical, aesthetic, hedonic, and prudential. Aesthetic has three subclasses, of which one is intellectual.
Where are those in the
hierarchy? They're separate. They're over here. Each of these perspectives provides reasons for and against any given behavior.
Those behaviors are seized descriptions, seized judgments.
Which these? Yeah, remember the diagram I drew was this. That this form of behavior is what C, the critic, has to be able to distinguish. Remember, it comes under an achievement description with everything else behavior.
The C is also performing deliberate action.
And C, you take it usually for granted that this is indeed a deliberate action, and that the one he chooses is exactly the one that he engages in, and that one is the giving of the criticism.
What is the significance in terms of your parameters of the role of the critic, the behavior of the critic?
There is no restriction. The behavior of an actual critic may have almost any significance that you can imagine. The role of the critic is unconnected to the significance parameter.
C's description, or C's appraisal of O's description, did you say that could be given by an achievement description?
Because what he asks when he's asking, is it true, is what does O succeed at?
And so then that's where you get the two achievement descriptions,
yeah.
Because O's is looked at as an achievement description.
Yeah. Yeah, correctness, rigor, precision, accuracy, relevance, there's all kinds of them that appear under that.
Yeah, related to that, the maxims are checks for internal coherence.
Truth via internal coherence. Take as an example, I can't say truly that this is a table if I can also say truly that it has no top. The internal coherence in the conceptual structure of table prohibits saying both this and this. So it's the internal consistency that connects them, the internal consistency, the internal structure of the concept of table. Likewise, the concept of behavior prohibits me from saying he's doing X, but right now he's unconscious. You can say there's no way that both of those could be true. Therefore, one serves as a check on the other. Then he's simply an observer describing. Remember, this is a special case of observing describing. Yeah.
So if the critic does not agree that the observer's judgment is that, or description is accurate, then he becomes the observer and goes back and tries to assess the basis upon which the disparity arose.
You may very well do that. But again, that's not the observer, that's not the critic anymore.
Yeah.
When he asks, how come he said this, whereas it looks that way, he's observer describer.
The critic appraises the observer's description of behavior.
Yeah.
Does he also appraise behavior?
He may not.
If he was appraising the behavior, what would he be comparing the behavior to?
Well, look, suppose that I look over there and say to myself, the guy's acting pretty hastily. And then you give me the description, he's acting cautiously. Now, both of those are appraisals. They're not appraisals of description, but they're appraisals. Now, I still have the same issue. You've said something about him that doesn't sound like what I would say, and that's gross.
And we need a critic to...
No, what I do is to generate possible descriptions. Just because you didn't say the same thing I said doesn't mean we disagree. Once I hear you say that, I look again or do something or just check out conceptually, does that fit? And even though it's an appraisal that you're making, I can still criticize it as a critic.
Yeah, you can do that. What role is someone taking when they say what you did is wrong?
Critic.
But they're not criticizing the description, criticizing it.
Yeah, okay. Remember what I said last time, appraisal and critic, that ideally I separate them. When I'm saying somebody is wrong or he acted foolishly, that's appraisal. When I say the description is false or it's true, that's a critic.
Both
of them I lump under appraisal.
It's all appraisal, but that's all in the critic's role.
Yeah.
Can a behavior be seen as a product?
Of what?
In terms of a critic appraises products, right? Generally.
Yeah, but then if he's appraising the product, he's not appraising the entire behavior. See, if I appraise only the description that you give, I'm not appraising the behavior that you engaged in giving. And I can do either or both sides of things. See, for example, I can say what he said was true, but it was foolish of him to say so. In the first case, I'm appraising this as true. In the second case, I'm appraising this as foolish.
So the first would be
an appraisal of the product. The second is an appraisal of behavior.
And the first would be rule of critic, and the second would?
The second would be an appraisal.
Okay, it seems, it seemed, did you get the idea that when you said what you did was wrong, that that was the role of the critic?
You have to make that statement.
No. You're saying that it's not the role of the critic.
No, I'm saying.
To say what you did was wrong.
Yeah. Let me try something here. Now, when this is a description, when you have a critic, when you have someone appraising a description, they say that's a critic and he's criticizing a description. When you have somebody appraising a behavior, they say he's making an appraisal. But in both cases, it's the C in this AOC. And it's these two terms that have generated confusion, because essentially it's the same notion. And the distinction is simply over here, whether you're dealing with this, a description or not. And it's important enough to be worth doing something like this, but at the same time, it's trivial enough to be confusing at times.
It seems as though we need some concept of appraisal in the behavior part, because someone couldn't behave without making an appraisal of the situation.
But that's the point of calling these roles, and saying that an actual person can be doing all of these simultaneously. Indeed, over here, the K will always contain some appraisal.
Okay. Now, what general language of that could be called critic? Could it be or could it generally be used when appraising the appropriateness of the description other than knowledge of what was said and the answers?
The observation of what was talked about, or some knowledge of what was talked about. See, for example, I don't have to be looking at the table. If he says there's a green table in the room, to doubt it. So it's knowledge of the phenomena independently of the description that provides the major basis for criticizing the description. The limiting case is where you only have internal consistency in the description itself.
But there aren't any general bodies principles
of the maxims. No, you see, when it comes to tables, nobody's bothered to do anything like the maxims. When it comes to motors and automobiles, you could construct a few maxims yourself on the spot. See, again, it's the fact that behavior is of supreme interest to us, that we go to these lengths to clarify, to divide, to cross-check, etc. And there's hardly any other field, any other subject matter, in which we have this kind of interest and go to these lengths. But you could if you wanted to. If you were tremendously interested in motors and in describing motors and in making motors, you could do something of this.
Wait, for an appraisal, this is taking away the judgment of truth?
No, that's the point. That truth is primarily, in fact, exclusively applicable to descriptions, whereas other appraisals like foolish, wise, etc., are applicable to behavior generally. And that's the point of separating out critic from appraisal
generally.
More general.
Likely not to be true for the behavior, like the description is true for the behavior,
right. Like the other. Right. See, if I say it's dangerous, it's foolish, it's wise, it's reckless, I'm talking about behavior generally. If I say it's true, it's correct, it's accurate, or things like that, I'm either certainly or very likely talking about descriptions.
And you would you look at the ethical, the appraisal?
No, all of it.
Not in this, you know, in the best interest.
If I say, oh, it would be unpleasant, that's a hedonic appraisal.
In order to criticize a description, okay, I guess any of the perspectives could be used, right? However, usually it's the intellectual, is that correct?
For descriptions, yes.
Is that always true? So you could criticize a description based on that?
Yeah, see, when I said it was foolish of him to say so, but notice that they're criticizing the behavior and not just the statement.
If you're criticizing the statement, only the behavior has to be intellectual.
Yeah. Because products can't be foolish or wise, etc. They can be true or correct or accurate. People can be foolish, wise, reckless.
Whenever you begin to talk about the reasons why someone does something, then you always become a critic. Is that correct?
No.
The observer doesn't talk
no,
about
the observer can very well talk about this. For example, I can say he jumped out the window because he was afraid of this lion walking in. And that's a description. On the other hand, if I'm here when the lion walks in and I say that lion is dangerous, I'm making a prison. Why? Because look, my being here and seeing that lion as dangerous to me gives me a reason for doing something. My seeing that the lion is dangerous to him doesn't per se give me a reason to do anything. And that's the difference between appraisal and description. An appraisal gives you a reason to do something, whereas a description, a mere description, does not. I use the word mere description because appraisal is a form of description.
It sounds like you're allowing appraisals that aren't appraisals of behavior.
Yeah, of situations too. You know, the storm is dangerous. Incidentally, I just recently thought of something that may shed some new light on this AOC division. The AOC division is formally very closely analogous to a negative feedback loop. You think of a simple thing like a thermostat. A thermostat has some kind of mechanism that has an effect out here on your heater. And that effector, that executive, is like the active. A thermostat also has something that is sensitive to what's going on there, to the heat. And that's like your observer. And a thermostat has something in it that evaluates what it senses as good or bad, or acceptable, not acceptable, or something of the sort. And depending on which way it goes, whether it's good or bad, it has a link back here, so that the effector, the actor, changes depending on the evaluation. Now think of people in the same way, that you do something, you observe what it is you're doing, you decide whether it's acceptable or not. If it's acceptable, you continue. If it's not, you change what you're doing. Now, the link is by no means surprising, since people are the model on which computers are built. And not vice versa. So as I say, seeing in the simple case of something like a thermostat, how these things operate together and why you would need each one, I think it would help you understand why these are supremely important in human behavior and why this is not just an arbitrary division into three ways of talking. Okay, let's go on to the further maxims. The second maxim was that if you recognize an opportunity to get something you want, you have a reason to try to get it. The third maxim deals with what happens when you have a reason. And that one says, if a person has a reason to do something, he'll do it unless he has a stronger reason not to. Think of this kind of situation where each perspective gives you some reason for or against engaging in a given behavior. And think of reasons as being stronger or weaker than one another. And think of that notion as being an explication of the notion of value, which set a hierarchy of priorities among motivations. I said that the hierarchy referred to inequalities, not absolutes, but inequalities of more and less. Well, here we're exploiting that in talking about a stronger reason. The maxim says, whatever reason you have that is stronger than the other ones, that's the one that you'll act on. Now, this one is tautologous because that's how we decide which reasons are stronger than which. Remember when I was talking about the hierarchy of motivations? I said, we do have ways of deciding which motivations count for more with people, because we have a paradigm situation in which you have A and B, and the situation is such that if you get one, you can't get the other, and that the person has free access, an opportunity to get each one. Given that setting, whichever one he picks is the one he wanted more than the other. So since we have that way of deciding which one he wants more, you simply reverse that notion and you have maxim three. That if he does something, he wanted that more than whatever other alternatives he had in mind. So this is a different way of bringing in the same notion as value, namely a multiplicity of motivations which have differential force. Oh. Any questions about this maxim?
Usually when you act, you have a whole set of reasons for acting. Mm-hmm. Some of which say you should do something, some say you shouldn't. It seems like there's a complex interaction rather than just a simple hierarchy of reasons. Because two or three reasons may combine to do a stronger reason than two of the other reasons. But you couldn't derive that by saying that reason one is stronger than reason two is stronger than reason three.
And could.
How did you
conceptually, it's hard to make decisions of that sort unless you have this simple free choice situation. But conceptually, it's easy to think of my being slightly attracted to this behavior hedonically, put off strongly because it's dangerous, like Evel Knievel jump. But also attracted prudentially because I'll make a lot of money even though it is dangerous, you see. And you can imagine that I'm less put off by the danger than I am attracted to the money. And that the attraction to the money is stronger than the pleasure that I expect to get. It's when it comes to actually deciding in particular cases who has what that may be difficult, but conceptually it's easy to imagine.
There's no general way from the hierarchy of values.
It's not easy because you have overlaps, and that's what the next maxim deals with. It's hard to know sometimes when two reasons are separate reasons and when they're the same reason or partly the same reason. So again, keep in mind the distinction between the conceptual formulation and the problems of practical judgment as to when you have a case of what. Because that's going to reappear over and over again. There's plenty of things that are conceptually are very simple that generate all kinds of agonizing when you try to make judgments about particular cases.
Actually, the tautology is also one-way tautology, because you can say, seeing a person doing something, you can say, well, is there motivations that led to that being done? But just seeing motivations.
Well, you don't see motivations.
Or reasons.
Well, you don't see reasons.
About
That would help.
So reasons can be inferred and not observed?
No. Hold off that question and remind me when we get to what I call the judgment diagram, because that's where you talk about these reasons and how you tell, etc. And it's not inference. Take it as a given that unless I say something is a matter of inference, it never is. I'm giving you a warning.
If there's a hierarchy of values, must there necessarily be one most important value?
Well,
what's at the top of that hierarchy?
Yes and no. If you have a simple hierarchy, the answer is yes. If you don't, then you don't have to have a single one. See, look, the paradigm of a hierarchy is a branching tree like this. Now, clearly, in point of fact, there needn't be one thing. You can have a branching tree like that. We start with two things. And again, you see, the paradigm is what we use conceptually, and then when you describe people, you may decide that this particular person doesn't fit this. You just transform by removing the top link and say, here's the one he fits. Now, if you could then set up these two in a free choice situation, you would almost always find that one of them did take precedence over the other. But conceptually, you can say it could happen.
Critically, there are cases where that choice can't be made and behavior occurs as paralysis or as confusion or possibility.
Yeah. On the other hand, here again, practically speaking, you almost never have only those two choices. There's some unknown number, and very often you only find out after the fact by watching what he does that reminds you of one of the choices he had and actually took that you wouldn't have thought of ahead of time. Now, as you can see, the way the thing is phrased, if a person has a reason to do something, he'll do it unless he has a stronger reason not to. It has that genuine air of triviality that I mentioned. It's a simple and compelling sort of formulation. Now, on the other hand, you might say it's obviously false. And that creates problems. Because on the one hand, it seems to be obviously true, but on the other hand, it seems to be obviously not true. And there are two sorts of examples that you might think of in saying it's obviously not true. The first is, suppose that you know something about me and you're confident that you know what it is that I want most, you know, what it is that ranks first on my hierarchy. And then you say, well, according to this principle, that's what he ought to be doing all the time. Because if that's what he wants more than anything else, and the principle says that whatever you want most, you're going to be doing, then that's what he ought to be doing all the time. And you know that isn't so. You know that in general, a person is not always trying to achieve the one thing that he wants most. So you can say, given that fact, that maxim is in trouble. Now, the other kind of fact is that very often you either say or hear dialogue like this. Okay. At 8 o'clock tonight, I got an appointment to do an intake interview, and I'd really rather go down and have dinner, but I'm going to do the intake interview. Now there, what I seem to be saying directly is that the thing that I'm more strongly motivated to do, I'm not going to do. That I'm going to do something that I'm less strongly motivated to do. Well, given that you have even apparent counterexamples like that, you can't just let it rest. You either have to explain them away, change the maxim, or do something. So what we have to make it all come out even again is maxim four. And maxim four will enable us to keep maxim three the way it is, in the face of the kinds of things that I've mentioned. However, it's a bit tricky, and I think it's probably the only one that is tricky. Now, maxim four also deals with motivation, and it says if a person has two reasons for doing something, he has a stronger reason than he would if he had only one of those reasons. And notice the coordination. So if I have these two reasons for engaging in a behavior, I have a stronger reason than if I only had one of these. It doesn't say I have a stronger reason than if I only had one reason. It says I have a stronger reason than if I only had one of these. The reason it works that way is if I didn't have a stronger reason given both of these than I did if I had only this, you'd say, what do you mean this is a second reason? You wouldn't accept this as an additional reason. The same way, if you said, say, well, hell, you haven't added anything to A. So here you're, in effect, saying, if this doesn't give you a stronger reason than just having this alone, you haven't added any motivation, therefore you don't really have an additional reason. So the maxim states then, if you have two reasons, that's stronger, gives you a stronger reason than if you had only one of those. Now, you have to work to connect this to the kind of problem that we set up over here. And I suspect the best way is just to invent some imaginary numbers. Consider the strength of my reason for doing X, and let's call that my reason for doing X. And let N equals the strength of that reason. And let's talk about my reason for doing Y, and let N be the strength of that reason. Now, in the statement, I'd rather do X, but I'm going to do Y, I'm telling you that this reason is stronger than this one, but this is the one that I'm going to do. Now, what we need to do here is invent a new behavior. In fact, we can invent two new behaviors here. And let's label one Q. Each of these is a new behavior. Each of them is a different behavior than either of these. Now we can ask, what reason would I have for engaging in Q or R? And the answer is whatever reasons I'd have for doing them separately, I'd have for doing both of them. Either both of them together, or first one and then the other. Now, at this point, you make use of the maxim and say, you don't know how strong a reason this is, but one thing you can say
But I have more reason to do both than I have to do either one. And then referring back to Maxim 2, I will have this reason if I can see an opportunity to do both or to do first one and the other. So you first construct in a purely formal way the possibility of reasons of this sort, which are stronger than either of the ones we started out with. And then you refer back to the previous maxim and say, yeah, by gosh, this could really happen. All that would be needed is that the individual should recognize an opportunity to do both A and B, or to do first A, then B. And since we commonly do recognize opportunities like that, it's clear that we're not talking about just purely hypothetical happenings. This is the kind of thing that people do indeed see. Now, if I have stronger reasons to do first X than Y, then that will help explain why I'm not always doing the one thing that I have most reason to do. Because no matter how strong a reason I have for doing the one thing that I want most to do, I can have a still stronger reason for doing something else. For example, suppose that I said, well, I'm facing that interview versus coffee right now. And really, right now, having that cup of coffee is the one thing I want most. But I'm going to do the interview. And then I say, aha, what's to keep me from having my coffee during the interview? And if I can see my way clear to doing that, I will have a stronger reason to do both the interview and have the cup than merely to have the coffee or merely to do the interview.
I understand combining the two, but doing one with the exclusion of the other, and if the one you're excluding is the one you most want to do, then...
No, but look, you see, saying first one, then the other, at this time, I'm not doing this one. But since I've combined the two into one behavior,
so you're not saying that the strength of the first reason is stronger than the second. It's just strength when you see them together.
One, yeah, when you see this as a single behavior, then the strength of that reason is greater than either of these. And therefore, see, this is how you can postpone doing the thing you want most.
That was very painful. But the same kind of question she just raised in terms of when you think that you will become excluded, should you ask for the first, then would you say that but the observer just doesn't have a good idea of what the real reasons for you choosing?
Better give me the concrete example. Can you do it in terms of the coffee and the interview?
You need an example. Well, before dinner and an interview, because you're the interview, you can't go to dinner.
Yeah. Well, that's why I said that formally you can set this up, and it's not until you go back to Maxim 2 that you say, here are the conditions under which you could actually have this, namely, if you recognize an opportunity. Now, if there is no opportunity, then you're back to the situation of what counts for more. Except that opportunities for doing first A and then B are very common. See, they're only mutually exclusive at the same time. I can certainly do first one then the other. At least normally I can do first one then the other.
Could part of it then be that when you're talking about one, you tend to read that with a few dots floating?
No. I saw one head nodding, but...
Could I just add to that? The way I see it is that you feel that you're not this is what you really want to do, then you have to, you know, might be judicious to have the interview for whatever reasons, and the judicious doing the interview, it outweighs the benefit you get from the pleasure that you might have meeting with whatever else. But when you head, you say, wow, I really want to, but it's going to feel good.
Okay, but what are you? Why would you put it in the form of I really want to do X, but I'm going to do Y, when all that you described is that reason X counts for me more than reason Y?
Because we, like at least I do, I think from the back, all
yeah.
And
Well, remember what we said about these, that if you adopt a particular theory, you can give priority to one of these, but you can give priority to any of them.
Well, it's not really giving priority to the same.
Well, yeah, because if you say, what I really want is always some hedonic, and the others are merely the things that qualify my hedonic impulses.
Well, you're, that is a rule, you're saying when that particular person said, I want what he was meaning was, they said God agrees with, it's not as strong as that.
Right. Remember, the formulation was, I really would rather do X, but I'm going to do Y. It's not merely, I want to do X, but I'm going to do Y. I say, I would rather do X than Y, but I'm going to do Y. So that's giving some kind of priority. It's not merely talking about two reasons on a par and saying that one is stronger than the other.
It seems that way to me. It seems that the person is saying, my design is not as strong as my ethical reason. That basically.
Look. Here's what you would be saying if it was merely that when you say want, it was hedonic and others you deal with separately. It would amount to that you want Y more than you want X. But that's not what you're saying here, that you'd rather do X, but you're going to do Y.
Because I'm used to seeing my mode being hedonic, but also it might be judicious, it might also, because to stay in the program, I might have to do my interview. So therefore, what I really want is to stay in the program more than I want to eat.
Okay, but that's fine. You want Y more than you want X.
No, wait, you still got to look into your usage there. I think what it does is it kind of points out the distinction between two ways of talking.
Well, yeah, I'm saying that if when you say this, all you mean is this, you are giving some priority to which one? This one. See, if all you mean is that one of these counts for more than you, but you put it in the form of, I really would rather do X than Y, you're treating this one in a special way. Whereas all it amounts to is not that it's special, but that there's an inequality. And then if that's the way you're treating it, this is not a counterexample of the other. This is not a counterexample of Maxim 3. This is simply an instance of Maxim 3. Whereas, when I say I'd rather do X, but I'm going to do Y, I really mean that I'd rather do X, but I'm going to do Y.
Couldn't you always make everything in case of Maxim 3?
Yeah, but only with Maxim 4. So once you have Maxim 4, then you can say, yeah, Maxim 3 holds. Let me suggest a reading for this. Namely, here. When I say I'd rather do X than Y, I'm saying this one is greater than this one. But in only referring to the want, I'm leaving out reference to the reasons. If I have strong reasons for doing Y, even though I want to do X more, my motivation may pick out Y anyhow.
Well, in that case, it seems at the top, since there's someone in between that the person really means it. You'd really rather do X, but you will do Y than X.
No, because it might be this. So what it is non-committal as to which solution is in the picture.
But it's implying at least one.
It's implying one of these, or you might say it's only possible if there are such solutions. See, and then if you take account the total motivation and not just the want, and that's what reasons add. Reasons are not just wants. Take account the total motivation and contrast that with just the wants. That's how come you can have wanting one thing more than another and still have stronger reasons to do the thing you want less.
And that doesn't necessarily imply that you're ever going to be able to make up and do the thing that you wanted more. I mean,
right.
You could have going to a meeting or watching a football game and they're mutually exclusive. You just want it to be good.
Right. Okay, so you see that we have two sorts of things in the picture, We have the contrast between reasons and wants. And one's motivation involves both, not just wants and not just reasons, but both. Therefore, you can have stronger reasons to do the thing that you want less. And that's why we can talk this way and not just be spinning words. See, there is some informative value there in contrasting this, because you might say that's an unfortunate circumstance if you're in a position where you have stronger reasons to do the thing you want less.
When you say, just going back to the example of interview versus eating, aren't you saying I want to serve this person, or I want to stay in the program, I want to do one of these things more than I want to eat it? Isn't that the final decision that comes down to it? Because you obviously you don't want to do the interview, but there's something about the interview that you want more.
I'm separating wants from reasons. Saying in that situation, if I want this more than this, but I'm going to do this, then I have stronger motivation. Since the stronger motivation doesn't consist of stronger wants, it must consist of stronger reasons.
But doesn't the reasons support the wants?
No, that's what I'm saying, that they can conflict. And if they do conflict, it's unfortunate. In fact, it's often pathogenic. But they can. I can have reasons to do things that I don't really want to do. Now, you can reintroduce the word want in talking about the total motivational package consisting of reasons and wants, and then go back to Maxim 3 and say, when you take all of that into consideration, whatever you do is what you wanted most to do. But that's introducing the same word for which we have a different use. And that's why I talk about motivational priorities. Motivation includes both wants and reasons. Let's see. Let's go counterclockwise.
Yeah, if you say, but will do what, that's a reason.
No. Yeah, I'm implying that I have a reason, but all I'm saying is that I'm going to do what.
I thought the wants were what you want to do, as opposed to reasons which would force you not to do that.
No, you can have reasons for doing something as well as reasons against.
And then you can have wants not to do something.
Remember,
like you're switching it down.
No, want is always, no, okay. You specify a state of affairs as the value of want. The state of affairs is what you want to be the case. Now, given that framework, you can always turn it into a negative. For example, if I say what I want to be the case is that the lion should not be in the room. You can always form negatives out of positives formally that way. But still, what I want to be the case is different from my reasons for behaving in this way. Remember, the behavior includes this whole thing. And I have reasons for that whole package. Whereas the want is simply the value of the parameter. That's what I was saying last time. That's why reasons are not parameters of behavior. They're something a little different enough to not just incorporate them as a motivational parameter.
Subcategories, so to speak.
Well, they're part of motivation, but not this part. Because this is part of a package which reasons operate on as a whole package. And something that operates on this whole package can't be part of the package. And so there's just no way formally to plug in reasons right here. But there is something motivational here, and that's why we have two motivational terms. In a way, it's comparable to having two competence terms. We have know-how and we have ability. But they're different places for competence terms, but they can't be the same one. They're different places for motivational terms, but they can't be the same motivational concept. So wants and reasons are the particular ones, and motivation covers both wants and reasons.
You could say reasons derive out of knowing the facts.
Well, remember Maxim 2. Maxim 2 almost literally says it. It says, if you recognize an opportunity, which is facts, you have a reason.
If you just add, I would rather do X, but will do Y because I have reasons to.
Yeah. See, if you give the reasons, it stops sounding paradoxical.
I would like to throw in a couple of different cases. One would be doing neither X nor Y, which could be called a postponement. And waiting perhaps for more reasons for vacation.
Yeah, well, that's simply a special case of this.
Not necessarily. Mm-hmm. Because if neither is chosen, you cannot choose one of them.
No, no. Once you have this, you can always have first Q, then first X, then Y. It's the same pattern.
Okay, but if neither X nor Y ever enters the behavior again, that's an alternative, because X and Y disappear.
Yeah, but that implies that you have other things you want to do more, which again is back to max and three.
I mean, if you interject Q, then you're waiting until you can do both together, maybe or something like that.
Yeah, and if you're postponing until you can do both together, then you've got a special case of first X and Y. Namely, first Q, no, let's say first Z, then both X and Y.
Okay, well then there's
and this is the same thing as this.
Okay, well then what are the alternative, neither X nor Y, but Z?
Well, as I say, if you have that alternative, then you go back to maxim three and say clearly you had a stronger reason for doing Z than for doing X or Y.
Okay, could the reason be I couldn't choose between X or Y, so I just chose something else?
It might be.
It seems to me there's a distinction here that isn't being covered by throwing this into Q and R.
Well, there's all kinds of distinctions that are not covered. Remember, you have to use these to generate other distinctions. This is not a taxonomy. It's not something that for every distinction you want to make, there is an explicit distinction here. It's a minimum set that you have to work to generate whatever distinctions you want. That's why, for example, this one you can generate using this pattern, but this one is not already there. And likewise, if you have special reasons like it's too difficult to decide between P and Q, therefore, since I would first have to decide in order to do either one, and I have no good opportunity to do that because I can't do that, then I'm going to do R. You go back to maxim 2 and say what it looks like is he didn't really have an opportunity. See, one way or another, you can fit these by working these distinctions. I will admit, sometimes you have to work hard. Well, remember, opportunity depends on capability. If it's not something that I can do by doing something I now know how to do, it's not an opportunity. Remember, it has to be doable before it's an opportunity. And if it's not doable because I can't make up my mind, then it's not doable. And then I don't have that opportunity, and then I look for other opportunities.
This is another instance we have to know an awful lot of facts. Individual situation. I just tell you, Sue, that I make a statement. I rather go eat. I really want to go eat, but I'm going to do the interview. And if you know that my ass is grass, if I don't get that interview written by 10 o'clock, I got to go to 8, write it up in 2 hours. I need out of the program. I have no further explanation. But if I say, make that statement to someone who doesn't have those facts, then they may be all confused.
Right. See, remember, communication is between people, and very often people know about each other, and if I know that you know about me, I don't have to tell you. If you don't, then I may tell you, or I may conceal it, or I may ignore it.
Well, I may not know about me either.
Mm-hmm. This is why, for example, when you're writing, you write in complete sentences and very carefully, whereas when you're talking, you often don't even utter a complete sentence. Why? Because the person you're talking to in terms of the context knows enough of what you're saying so that you don't have to say it all. You just supply a few key links there and he's got the message. Well, the same holds in interaction. You don't hardly ever do a complete self-presentation because mostly you're dealing with somebody who already knows something about you, and whatever he knows about you, you don't have to include in your self-presentation, including the fact that you might have very strong reasons for doing X.
Would it be valuable for you to include in the outline or the discussion to understand sort of a diagram of what reasons are? reasons involve wants, involve values, may involve interests.
No, no. We will have a diagram of that sort. That's the one that I was referring to, saying hold off until we talk about the judgment diagram. Because that's a different paradigm that's just doesn't neatly fit into this development, but does deal with it.
At this rate, though, it looks like if somebody makes an arbitrary choice,
like what? No choice is arbitrary.
Flip a coin over and make a decision that way. Say, you know, you really at this moment don't have a preference for, you know, whether you pull the back catch or the coach.
Mm-hmm.
It makes no difference.
Yeah.
Flip a coin over. It looks like by your, you know, when you work this out, some observer looks at the behavior and is almost forced to say, well, you have a strong reason for picking that one.
Yeah, if that's all he knows. If he knows you flipped the coin, then he can reconstruct that you couldn't make up your mind without the coin. Therefore, independently of the coin, your reasons were pretty much equal.
What about without the coin?
Well, if you needed to flip a coin to decide, then presumably if you didn't do the coin, you would do something comparable. Otherwise, we'd start looking for your reasons for doing it by flipping a coin. Normally, you can have good reasons for flipping a coin. Namely, it's the kind of situation where it doesn't matter which you do, but you've got to do one. And rather than doing a lot of agonizing and balancing reasons for doing one rather than the other, you simply flip a coin, and that will pick one.
That's an example of not knowing whether to do X or Y. So you do R instead to flip the coin, which may have an impact on each.
No, it's a case of not knowing whether to do X or Y, but since you have to do one or the other, you flip a coin and do whichever way it comes out. Why? Because one way is just as good as the other. Therefore, you can't decide on the basis of one being better than the other. Therefore, you decide on some other basis because you've got a reason for deciding. And that makes sense. See, that choice is not arbitrary.
So there would you say of the first problem, there was no decision that you made? In terms of
you made the decision to do X rather than Y, but you didn't make the decision on the usual basis. However, you had a reason for making the decision on the basis you did.
Can I also put it back, because I don't think I was very clear about which use of what you were using. Like, for example.
Well, I said, when somebody talks this way, I would interpret it as a reference to the want. See, this one literally doesn't literally refer to want.
But if they say it the other way,
See, and if somebody says this, I don't see any ambiguity or any problem there. This offers no problem of interpretation. This does.
Can you say it's a sloppy way of talking when people phrase it as a want?
No. These are all acceptable ways of talking. See, the fact is that you can talk in perfectly acceptable ways and still leave your listener uncertain as to what you said. That's because legitimate ways of talking are not ways of saying everything. See, if I say that's a table, you might ask, but how big is it? How much did it cost? I haven't told you that. That doesn't mean that I was talking sloppily by saying it's a table. So here, it's a perfectly good way of talking, except that it may leave the listener with questions that are important to him. So in ordinary language, it's dialogue that clarifies questions and gives you precision. Whereas in technical language, the questions are already settled ahead of time, and terminology settles the decisions and gives you your degree of precision. So in general, you can be much more precise in ordinary language than you can be in technical language. The reason is that there is no necessary stopping point in the dialogue in ordinary language. But with technical language, you're stuck with whatever level of precision you put in.
Can you say, rather than you are explaining why, you are as stronger than you are, why?
No, your WX is strong.
It shouldn't be your X.
Yeah.
I mean, like, what you say about the reason for
if the W is stronger here, then the reasons have got to be stronger the other way. If it's going to be the case that you rather do X but are going to do Y. Now, the maxim just deals with the reasons. The maxim is couched in terms of no. The reference to want here is simply a way of accounting for this sort of way of talking that at first glance seems to violate maxim 3. But you refer to maxim 4 by way of resolving the apparent contradiction, but maxim 4 literally only talks about reasons. The reason it doesn't need to talk about wants is we've already talked about wants in the concept of behavior itself. So we already have that available. So if you permit yourself to refer back to the notion of behavior here, including the want, then indeed when you add maxim 4 to maxim 3 and say both of them now will stand, there are no contradictions that you can point to now. Well, you can see why I said that maxim 4 is tricky. That it's a little bit further from the places you want it to give you answers than most of the others. Now, I will say that there's nothing sacred about the maxims. It's not that these are the 9 maxims and that's all there is and they have to be this way. There are various ways of unpacking the concept of behavior. And there's no guaranteed limit to the number of maxims that you could legitimately pull out. There's nothing that says that any particular set of maxims is the only possible one. However, this is a perfectly serviceable set. And until a better one comes along, that's what we have. But you might think of adding maxims or substituting some for the ones that are there, yes, because it's a possibility.
I was going to ask you what happened to maxim
10. Well, maxim 10, see, there's been one or two candidates for additional maxims that have been around for several years that almost make it, and yet I have qualms. And hypothetical maxim 10 is a therapeutic maxim that says if a person wants to do something, he has a reason to do it. And the reason it's therapeutic is that you use something like this primarily with somebody who has self-esteem problems and doesn't give himself the benefit of the doubt that even though he wants to do something, he needs another reason to consider it okay to do it. Whereas, you know, normally, if you want to do it, unless you have reasons not to, you go ahead and do it. So with a maxim like this, you see, it's a give yourself the benefit of the doubt type maxim, and that's why it's therapeutic. Now, the reason I haven't incorporated as a separate maxim is that I take it that that's implicit in the maxims that we have. But you could add it. Because I think you'd have a hard time denying that if you want something, that's a reason to do it. So you could end it. Another one, which goes way back, is that a person has reason enough to treat everything he does as being successful. Yeah. It has some of that aspect, that a person is always doing something, so there is always some description under which what he does is succeeding at something. No, any result is successful at something. Now, since what you're successful at is what is the case, how could you go wrong by focusing on that aspect of your behavior? You're simply being realistic.
Therapeutic.
Now, that's also therapeutic in other ways that we may get to later. Well, you can see that particularly the last one doesn't have quite that air of triviality that I want in this primary set. And that's one reason why it's not included. But you can also get a sense then for what kind of other maxims you might think of putting in.
Yeah.
That you're really starting with this concept of behavior in persons, and anything that you can separate out of it could conceivably serve as a maxim.